Hey, this is Francis from Restaurant Guys Radio, and we just want to say a thank you to the people from El Jimador Tequila. It's our house tequila at Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant, where we make delicious margaritas and all sorts of great cocktails. If you need a white tequila, El Jimador is the way to go, and they're bringing you this podcast. It will be, from this point, commercial-free.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on WCTCAM, restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hello, everybody. It's coming to you again from the Monteleone Hotel in New Orleans, where we are broadcasting from Tales of the Cocktail, the largest cocktail conference in the world. We are having an awesome time in New Orleans, both at the seminars during the day and going out at night. You have to come down here to just go to the bars. We went to French 75 last night.
Ah, what a great bar.
Oh, my
God. What a great bar. Francis and I, Francis got down here day before I did. You went to Cochon, which is the restaurant of the pig, the night before I got down here, and talked about that a little bit on our last show. Really cool place, I think, revolving around the pig. But there are so many interesting places here.
There's an bar, image in my head of revolving around a pig.
This bar at French 75 is really terrific. The bartender's spectacular. He's made for us something that I promise you we're going to make back in New Jersey when we get back there. He's made for us a cocktail, which is basically a praline washed rye.
Let me explain what fat. There is all the rage now. There's actually a seminar being given at this conference called Carnivorous Cocktails, where they talk about fat washing, and it's pretty cool actually. And if you've been reading, you know, the avant-garde cocktailians are doing, what fat washing is there's a bacon infused rye or bourbon that a lot of folks are doing, where you'll take bacon and you'll basically soak bacon or steep bacon in a spirit like a rye for a while and then strain it off. And what happens is they call that fat washing. And so in some fat, whether it's bacon or whatever kind of meat fat you want to do, whatever kind of fat you want to do, you infuse the spirit with the flavor and then you remove the fat at the end. So there's no fat left in the spirit, but you have bacon flavored bourbon. I think it's a bacon flavored bourbon and Coke that Evan Clem was mm-hmm. famous for. Mm-hmm. Well, what this guy has done is he wanted to do something specifically New Orleans, and so he used pralines.
Pralines, right? Call them pralines.
And it's the butter that provides the fat, and so it's got this sweetness and this nuttiness and
this richness from delicious. He used a mixture of a couple of different rye. And it just—he's really
rye one. He's rye one and old overhauled.
And old overhauled, right?
I can't remember my ex-girlfriend's name, but I know what went in the drink I had last night. Isn't that something wrong with me? I think.
Anyway, it definitely had some sweetness from the pralines, as he called them. And it had, but you got some nuttiness, and you got that richness from the butter, which again, there was no butter in this. It had been sifted off. I'm sure there were some of those solids. Had infused themselves into the rye, but there was none of that actually in the rye itself. And I will just tell you, it was
delicious. Oh
just,
my God.
Just really, really delicious. But you know what I found really interesting?
What?
Francis and I went back and we brought some of the cocktail people back. As we went down and actually drank him out of his praline rye, but I don't know if you even noticed this, Francis. As we went back there, the rye got sweeter and sweeter and sweeter as we got to the bottom of that.
Because one of the things that had washed off that I liked was the sugar also went mm-hmm. into the spirit. And so it had a certain rock and rye. I don't know if you remember rock and rye. Rock is rock candy solved in rye. And so it was just delicious. Of course, we stopped in the afternoon. Here's another New Orleans graciousness. We were in there. They opened at 5 o'clock. We were there at 4:45. We're looking in the window. The guy's mm-hmm. setting up the bar. He comes over. Beautiful, beautiful bar.
Beautiful old bar.
And He says, you guys, we open at 5. I was like, oh, okay. And he said, you know, if you want to come in and if you don't mind me setting up around you, I can let you in. I loved – okay, right now you're my best friend.
Mm-hmm.
So Mark and I sat in the corner in a bar that wasn't open, drank this amazing drink, had another amazing drink. And then, of course, that night later on, we show up with Del DeGroff and Audrey Saunders and who the heck else was with us. And Jill DeGroff and – and it was just amazing. It was an amazing,
wonderful thing. Wonderful place. Interesting, a lot of great cocktails while we were there. Obviously, French 75, is one of the cocktails it's famous for.
One of the things I think that's interesting about this conference, people say, well, what do you do down there? You all just go make cocktails? If you're making historical cocktails, you look them up and make them. That's not it. You know, it's a cocktail, especially these old historical cocktails, where the ingredients are sometimes no longer available, or they were always house made in the past. A cocktail recipe is kind of like a song, you know, and a different band plays a different song a different way. And so it's like all musicians getting together and they all, you know, shared Cole Porter renditions. It's not just the same song that you sing. And, you know, it's funny because there are changes that happen on purpose and there are miscommunications. And this is only tangentially related. I was talking to one of our bartenders who was an excellent bartender who was going off script a little bit, which is fine. We encourage mm-hmm. that. But she was making a drink, and it looked pretty good, and I hadn't recognized it. You know, what is that? And she said, well, this is my new thing. I said, what's that? She said, it's Pim's Cup.
I said, realize that a Pim's Cup, for those of you who aren't as cocktail geeks as Francis and I are, has been around for a really, really, really long time.
It's the official cocktail of Wimbledon. I mean, it's a serious cocktail, and we drink a lot of them down here in the afternoon because they're fairly low test,
mm-hmm.
and it's a little bit bitter, and it's cooling on a
very hot cooling in summer it, and finished with a cucumber, and it's just
Campari,
just a really very
lemon soda, gin, lemon lime soda, gin, or lemon lime soda or ginger ale, depending on where you are, gin, and
Pim's is what you meant to say.
Did I say Campari? Sorry, I meant Pim's. I'm an idiot. And I know this drink well. I Mark and I drink them, mm-hmm. and our bartender's making them. And she said, "It's Pim's Cup." I said, "Oh, I've had a Pim's Cup, and it doesn't look like that."
Why is
and
that?
And she said,
cloudy.
"No, I looked." And she said, "I looked it up. I looked it up in a very respected cocktail guide that we have in our library." And I'm like, you know, I don't get it. And I said, "What's
wrong?"
It? And she's basically made a lemonade with Pim's in it. And Pim's Cup and a cucumber. And it was actually quite tasty, entirely accidentally. And I said, you know, you can't sell that as a Pim's Cup. That's not a Pim's Cup. And what I realized was in the old recipe that we had in our antique cocktail book, it's a British book, and it says lemonade.
And remember, the British, when they talk about lemonade, they mean what we say when we say 7-Up.
Like a lemon-lime soda,
lemon
like a 7-Up. And so I was like, well, you know, that is sort of the lost-in-translation bit of a – that's not a Pim's Cup exactly, but maybe it is a
Pim's
Cup.
But maybe it's really good and enjoyable, and maybe we've created a whole new thing.
But that sort of dialogue is going on here on steroids. It's just an amazing conference down here. We're going to talk – in just a couple of minutes, with Dusan Zarek and Jason Kosmas. They are two of the owners of Employees Only. They've been on the show before after they published a book. Their bar is, I believe it's the highest grossing bar for cocktails per square foot in America and probably in the world. And they make quality stuff, and they're leaders in the field. And they're going to talk to – they did a wonderful drink. For those of you who are in the industry might find it interesting, they did a wonderful seminar called How to Turn Out Quality Cocktails and Bang Them Out Like a Maniac, which is, you know, a lot of these cocktail places that you go to, you get this perfectly crafted quality cocktail, and it takes 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes to make a drink. And that's not always possible. And Jason,
it happens in our bar. Lots of our cocktails take a very long time to make.
And Jason and Dusan have a different view than many people. They're kind of the bad boys of this conference, so we're looking forward to talking to them. You stick with us, and you can too. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We are still here in New Orleans at the Tales of the Cocktail, and we are sitting with two gentlemen who are at the pinnacle of our field. Jason Kosmas and Dusan Zarek own Employees Only, the Macau Trading Company. They do consulting, and they're legendary in the business. They have the highest grossing restaurant per square foot of cocktails in the country.
Hey, Jason, Dusan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Well, the last time we had you in the show, we were broadcasting from our own studio in New Jersey, talking about cocktails in general. But this is a pretty wild thing that we're involved in. You know, I mean, I remember when Employees Open. I remember when the Rainbow Room was the only place in New York that you could get great cocktails. This event that we're at, Tales of the Cocktails, 7 years old now. And for the first 3 or 4 years, it really wasn't a tremendous event. But for the last 4 years, it's don't you find this incredible, the number of people of here, how far they've come from, the level of interest? And, I mean, do you think this is an exciting, crazy thing, or is it just another trade show?
No, I mean, I think it's really exciting. I think that it really represents the growing acceptance and interest in cocktails around the country.
And it was long overdue. For too long has the American art of cocktails been neglected by Americans themselves.
Well, you know, it's funny, looking at the history of the cocktail, we often refer to like the 70s and the 80s as the dark ages of the cocktail.
Our generation had never seen a good cocktail.
We had Lisa.
You know, people our age just didn't know they existed.
We had Lisa Laird on the show, and we were talking about, you know, the thing that she's about to explode as people rediscover Applejack. Mm-hmm. And Mark and I related to her, you know, both of our first experiences with Applejack were the epitome of what was wrong with cocktails in the 80s, right? Because the bartender in 1986, an old person orders a Jack Rose, because only an old person would order a Jack Rose.
Right.
You reach for the Mr. Boston Guide, which was before Anthony Giglio had rewritten it and made it a great guide, and it's a terrible book full of wrong recipes. It then tells you to make your Applejack with sour mix out of a gun and store-bought grenadine made with corn syrup, and you make the drink and you think, why did anybody ever drink this, you know? And you know, there was no frame of reference. How did you guys come about your frame of reference? I met Dale DeGroff, who schooled me like a schoolboy, and I realized that, you know, it's funny. I remember sitting at Dale's bar, and I'd been a bartender for 6 or 7 years, and I thought, it was a wonderful experience, but I thought, my God, I'm doing everything wrong.
I don't know anything.
Well, it's the same thing happened to us. You know, we were bartending in a high volume place in New York City, Pravda, in the 90s. And you know, Dale comes around, and literally, you know, wipes the slate completely clean and says, "All right, this is how it's done. This is this is the heritage. This is the lineage you're receiving right now. This is how things are done. This is American. This is born here." And, you know, it was a revelation for Jay and I. All of a sudden we understood, man, we have a profession.
Yeah. Now, Dale was the first to really tell us that, first of all, it's okay to be a bartender. And second of all, that you could make a career and develop a profession out of it. And, you know, I was fortunate. My father was actually a bartender. Mm-hmm. And it's funny that you brought up Laird's. We were having a conversation because I didn't actually realize how close to where I grew up. I grew up about 10 minutes away from the
Scobieville?
Yeah, exactly. And my father was telling me how he used to make Jack Roses when he was a bartender, but the old way, you know,
right.
with fresh juices and with grenadine. And they also had another one with apple cider and Applejack that was the big drink down the shore.
Uh-huh.
But also, I was very fortunate. I worked at the old day as a barback in New Brunswick, and I worked under Chris Dimitri, who beat me up, but beat me up good. And so I had a good foundation.
Chris Dimitri is a mutual friend. The Old Bay is a restaurant and bar in town where the Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi are. And Chris was like the best beer guy in the tri-state area. And
he had
a real nose for quality, man.
Oh, he's a big part of why people are drinking microbrews and imports in this country.
Absolutely, absolutely. But then on to cocktails, when Dale came on to Pravda, was it as a consultant or was it he just came into the bar? How did that work?
He actually, Keith McNally actually hired him to set up the bar at Pravda initially. So basically, it was his footprint that was the foundation. And when we started, I had not actually met Dale, and I wasn't aware of him or aware that he had done it. But it wasn't before long that he came in to do another seminar, and we started to see what he was talking about and started to understand and really get a sense of balance in cocktail making.
I think one of the great things that Dale has always championed even more now is that, you know, you said, my God, you found we had a profession. Well, that's, you know, that made me want to cry when you said that, because I thought, You know, when Mark and I got into the restaurant business, Mark's family didn't tell his grandmother that he didn't go for the insurance job.
Told him I was working in banking. Now, who knew? You know, the restaurant profession is a respected profession, and banking is a not respected profession. So I've been all right.
Another example how things always turn around.
I think that people viewing it as a profession, or you gave a seminar, Dushan gave a seminar as part of this conference, a very good seminar. And we talked about, you know, bartending being a trade and being in the restaurant business being a trade. Now, you know, 30 years ago, if you said, oh, my son is a chef, you think, oh, cook, you know, you're a cook. And now, you know, no one would in America would quibble with the fact that being a chef is a very respected profession. And I think that bartenders rising to that same level, there shouldn't be a distinction, both in how we're seen by society and how a good bartender creates his product.
I want to talk about cocktail bars and how they're changing and what's happened over the last 10 years and what we think is going to happen over the next 10 years. Because cocktail bars are evolving just like they always do. They're continuing to evolve. There's this one moment in time. But we're about to, I think, move into another era. And you know, you guys have talked about this and your seminar, you mentioned this as well. I think a lot of people have, I don't want to say forgotten, that a cocktail bar is a business and it's a place where you need to make money. But it hasn't been the priority. The priority has been to kind of resurrect the great cocktail, and we'll worry about making money and that it's a business later.
I think the biggest problem that has come about is that people have basically decided to take the route of creating shrines to the temple. And something, a place that you can go and you can basically worship the cocktail in the way that it's supposed to be as far as they have deemed appropriate. And, I mean, I just feel like, you know, we make cocktails for people to enjoy. You know, don't think for a moment that we don't take it as passionately and as seriously as anybody else. But it's really, the cocktail is for the customer, not the other way around. And I think that this train of thought of just making it all about the cocktail, it makes it very inaccessible. It makes it very boring, and it could lead to the decline of the cocktail.
I have to agree with what Jason is saying, and that is currently we have two major trends going on. One, what Jay was mentioning, and the second one I would say, and that is my hope that this is the direction where the cocktail trends will evolve to, is kind of a marrying of the restaurant and the cocktail bar into one experience, where actually cocktail is taking in its rightful place in the overall gastronomical experience. You would find now more and more high-end and really four-star chefs looking at their bar programs, employing people like Jay and I to come and train the staff, overhaul the whole cocktail program, and thereby giving the whole experience at their restaurant a completely new shine, if you will. And, you know, Jay and I work for Jean-Georges as consultants, and, you know, we're very proud to be able to work with a chef of such degree. We also, at Macau, in our new restaurant, our chef is David Woltok from Chanterelle. So right there, the collaborative effort between a great chef and, you know, a great bar yields in an experience. There is nothing that overshadows the other thing. It is all based about the customer having a complete, fulfilling experience.
Yeah, and essentially just ensuring that every product that you offer in your restaurant is of quality.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you talk about unifying the experience, I think that one of the things that we've talked a lot about in this conference is unifying the experience of a bartender. Dale talks a lot about how to design a bar to begin with. You know, and a lot of folks, I mean, you hear bar owners and bartenders and people like you and we go out to dinner, and you'll hear people talk about some bar that they went into and somebody spent, you know, $5 million to design a restaurant. And they brought all these efficiency consultants to figure out where to put every last piece of equipment in the kitchen, and the bar was just thrown together by what looks good. And you're like, we're talking to Audrey Saunders last night, and she went to a bar, and she's like, okay, where's the bin? It's over where? It's,
you know, right, there's no place to make the cocktail.
And I think that the greater emphasis being given on bar design has a lot to do with the idea that the construction of the bar should be the same as in the kitchen. You need a place for your mise en place, just like your chefs, your cooks need to be able to cook, your bartenders need to be able to take the stuff that's prepared in advance and go.
No, it's true. You have to have independent stations behind the bar to be able to do any kind of volume. It's just, it just doesn't work any other way.
It is inevitable. The cocktail bars today that are kind of serving the resurrection of the cocktail, I think should look a lot at how big and successful kitchens are producing their meals. If you hear any 3 or 4 star chef boasting about his night, he will tell you how many covers he did.
That's exactly mm-hmm. right. That's exactly
you know?
Right.
And this is something that is done in a very professional and studied way. There is an it's an exact science.
Well, and let me just point out that when you say that, for those of us who don't, you don't hang out with a lot of restaurant people, when a chef says, you know, a chef, the guy, you'll hear guys in the kitchen talk like, we banged out 600 dinners tonight. And what they mean, of course, is we banged 600 dinners, no sendbacks, you know.
Right.
We banged out 600 dinners, and they were all spot on.
Right.
Screw you. You know what I mean? And that's
right. We're not talking about 600 dinners. We work in a factory, or we work at 600 gourmet meals, and they were perfect.
Well,
that's what we're talking about.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's a point of pride. But in and you point out, and you guys, I guess, ruffle a few feathers sometimes, because you point out that in some places there's like one bartender spending 9.5 minutes making sure the ice is arranged perfectly on a single drink, and that the twist is 1 centimeter across, and everything is perfect. And you guys have a problem with that.
Well, it's, you know, it's just not what we do. You know, I really have to be honest with you. It's you know, our menu and the way that we construct our menu, it's all in conception. Just like when you're talking about the kitchen, it's like, what is feasible to put out? What is feasible to pump out? You know, you'll have dishes. Like, if you're dealing with a kitchen, you might have something that has got foie gras or some kind of ingredient that's going to give you a little bit of street credibility. It might be difficult to prepare, difficult to make. But you also know it's not going to be ordered as frequently. So you have to balance your menu. Of course, your vodka drink that you have on the menu, as much as you might not like to play with vodka, you're going to have the vodka drink, just like there's a chicken dish. And it's going to be the most ordered, and you're going to be able to pump that out.
I think that was a great analogy for some of the people in our industry. We have, you know, the chicken dish and the vodka drink are ordered by people. So you need to pay attention to the fact that they have to be good and that they're going to get ordered, and you better be ready to prepare them.
Listen, the people that are really interested in your cocktail program or your restaurant and your dishes, they are always going to come with friends. And they may not be as interested in what you have to offer. So you really have to make sure that you are able to meet everybody's needs. You have to have a well-balanced menu. There's no other way to do it.
Well, and I think cocktails are the same way. There sort of was an anti-vodka feeling for a long time, and I think that's reversing for a number of reasons. One is, like, you know, we have a fine dining restaurant, right? We have a fine dining restaurant stage left. And, you know, we have a chicken dish on the menu, and it's a damn good one, I will tell you. Now, that doesn't mean I have to put hot dogs on the menu. But I have to put chicken on the menu, and I have to put a salad on the menu, and I have to have a vegetarian selection. And I think our cocktail menus need to be the same. No, you don't need to have wine coolers behind your bar, but you do need to have a vodka drink, whether you like vodka or not. That's like going to a kitchen where the pastry chef says, do you have chocolate ice cream? No, we don't have anything chocolate. Why? The pastry chef doesn't like it.
Dushan, you touched on something a few minutes ago that I kind of want to go back to, and it's the marriage of great restaurants and great cocktail programs. And I think it's great that guys like you, who really came from cocktail bars, that was, you know, your focus was the cocktail bar. But the realization that great restaurants are going to have great cocktail programs. And for me, I think that's one of the big trends of the next 5 years, that there won't be a great restaurant that doesn't have great cocktails. Maybe they won't serve every cocktail, but you have to have some great cocktails because it's part of the whole overall experience. So do you see that as the trend? Do you see that as a necessity?
I believe that this is a natural evolvement of things that are happening right now. You know, the mainstream is open more and more to, you know, people who come into bars and restaurants actually do ask to see the cocktail menu. So consequently, you will have to see more and more people realizing the importance of a good bar program, especially when one sees how much profit in a really good executed bar and cocktail menu there is.
And, you know, another thing, too, is, when we opened up Employees Only, the idea of having a restaurant that served cocktails, when we told people what we were doing, they're like, oh, you're a lounge. It was just always this association that if you had a cocktail program, you know, you either didn't have food or food was the afterthought. And I think if you just look at the New York Times and see places that are being reviewed, and you see these more and more, these kind of, they, I think they call them like bar restaurant hybrids, you know, are appearing more and more on people's radar.
Well, you know, and I think it's more and more an idea that really made sense all along. You know that, of course, in the 50s, any restaurant would you be able to get cocktails. And most places where you could get cocktails, you would be able to get food. I want to go back and talk about profitability. And I'm going to ask some questions, of course, if you don't want to share with me numbers or methods of your own restaurant. I get it. Was I correct when I said that your restaurant is, or your cocktail bar is one of the highest grossing per square foot?
Yeah, it is the highest grossing cocktail restaurant in the country. In other words, we sell 140,000, in 2008, we sold 140,000 shaken or stirred cocktails. That does not account spirits served on the rocks, spirits served as shots, highballs, beer, wine, beverages.
So these are shaken cocktails that a bartender had to put in a shaker, shake and strain it into a glass or pour over.
Everything we pour through the shaker is in that number of 139, 800.
And how many staff, and I think a lot of people are going to be really shocked, how many bar staff do you have on a night?
We have two bartenders and one apprentice barback.
Wow.
That's a lot.
You guys need anybody?
And
I got Tuesday nights free.
And
I'm
we do this in 1,200 square feet.
It's unbelievable.
That's amazing.
It is unbelievable the production that you get out of such a small area.
Can I ask what kind of gross that turns into?
That turns into spirit gross for 2008 was $4.6 million.
Made by three guys at a time.
Correct.
That's it's unbelievable. And obviously you're doing something. You know, your cocktails are great. We know that your cocktails are great. America knows that your cocktails are great. But obviously you're doing something that a lot of the other places aren't doing.
Well, I think that the one thing that we really try to accomplish in creating the menu is we also want to make things accessible. We have people that are coming definitely for the cocktail program. We also have people who have no idea about it. And we don't, when they come in the door, we don't shove it down their throats. Like, we really just try to let them, like, ease them into it. Get them to order one cocktail, they'll go for the vodka one. Next one, you gain trust. And this is what we teach our staff. Teach them how to not show them what they want to show the people, but to show the people what they want to have. And I think that's the most important thing. The menu will always try to incorporate some ingredients that people are interested in and that they're knowledgeable about, whether it be the use of a fresh pomegranate juice, doing a chai-infused vermouth.
And obviously paying attention on seasonal ingredients, which is a big part of our program and our approach.
You know what I have to say? Your cocktails are wonderful and considered among the best in New York, and that brings the people in. And your food is great in your restaurant, and that brings the people in, and people have a good experience. Still, your marketing is incredible to bring that many people into that smaller restaurant and consistently bring them back. But what's really amazing that I think most operators and most people who run a system are amazed about, and one of the things that Mark and I are amazed about, is if I had that many people trying to come into my, if I had that demand, the ability to take that many people and churn out the cocktails in a quality fashion to that many people a night, what do you do differently that allows you to be able to, just give us some examples. I mean, I can't have your whole business plan, I know, but what are some of the kind of things that you do to make sure that your bartenders, how long does it take your bartender to make an average drink, a shaken drink, how long do you want it to take?
30 seconds.
So 30 seconds. So in 10 minutes, I should be able to turn out 20 drinks.
It should. You know, it's interesting, actually, when we did the math, and this is accounting for slow times as well.
I just want to give people a little perspective. The average cocktail in a cocktail bar takes 3 to 4 minutes to make in the average cocktail bar.
In the high end, like, you know, some of the other places that we talked about. And I don't know about the average, but like the built cocktail.
Sure.
I've seen people spend 3 and 4 minutes on cocktails.
Well, when you look at that 140,000 shaken or stirred cocktails, and that's without all the other stuff. We basically plugged it into the amount of hours that were open in 1 year, and the amount of bartenders that we have, and that's an average of 3 cocktails per minute. There's a cocktail poured every 3 minutes.
Right.
And so basically, that's with slow times and busy times. And that's taking the order, obviously, putting the money in the register, making the drink, all that stuff included.
And having a conversation. Because I've talked to your bartenders for 10 minutes.
I've talked to you behind the bar.
And that does not take into the account all the other orders that you would get besides a shaken or stirred cocktail, meaning, you know, glasses of wine, bottles of wine, champagne.
Sure, food.
Food, you know, spirits on the rocks, highballs, and so on.
Yeah, the important thing, too, is to teach people, to teach your staff how to be able to multitask and how to be able to put, you know, it's just like, again, we always make the comparison to the kitchen. How do you get 3 cocktails on the burner at one time? You know, when you have a big order, you got to be able to make, you have to have the capability to make them all. you may not be shaking them all at one time, but you're lining them up, you're pouring them. You have to have that sense of urgency and that ability to have precision.
And the most important thing is in your preparation. You have to be able to invest in your labor and hire a specific position that will ensure that your bar is preset, meaning a person comes in the morning. Basically, when we are finished at 5 in the morning and employees only, our bar porter, Santiago, arrives and starts preparing the bar for the next night. That, you know, so he's there 12 hours before the bar actually opens.
So he works 5 to 5?
He works 6 to 6.
And what
he does is basically he squeezes juice, labels it, stores it appropriately for the following night. He restocks every bottle on the back bar. So when you walk into employees only, you are greeted by a bar that's very well stocked, looks lush and plump and full. So it's welcoming. It gives out an impression that somebody's taking care of that bar. There is no dirt on the shelves. The bottles are all shiny. He makes sure that the orders are in, so for the next day we have enough fruits. He prepares all the fruits for the bartenders to cut for their shifts. He does a tremendous amount of work to make sure that we, when we come to actually prepare the bar for the service, have everything already in store for us. He's like a prep kitchen person.
And also, I have to say, Rob, who is our bar manager, is also producing and fabricating ingredients that add richness and depth to our cocktails. And all that time, and granted, we also come in 2.5 hours early to set up that bar. All that time that we save making cocktails quickly is all earned beforehand. It's all earned in the preparation.
It's still time spent, but it's time spent when the customer's not waiting for a cocktail.
You know, exactly. What's funny, after your seminar, and you spoke about, and Dushan, you said something that rang very clearly in my head. And you said the bar back is crucial because a bartender, you have people there willing to spend money, wanting to spend money, and time is going by. Closing time is coming, and you don't get that time back. And you said the bartender should be taking orders, making drinks, putting money in the cash register. If the bartender is doing anything else, you've made a mistake. You're wasting an opportunity if there are people at your bar
Correct.
Who want drinks.
Correct.
And I was at a bar last night here in New Orleans, and there were two bartenders on. It was packed. There probably should have been three to begin with. And they were running out of stuff. And the bartender jumped out from behind the bar, and he went and he got a case of stuff to restock. And I'm thinking, that guy was gone for 10 minutes.
Yep.
And in those 10 minutes, he should have been able to make 15 drinks that they're not going to get made now.
And the bottles were not neatly organized on the bar, and they didn't know exactly where each bottle was. And it was just –
See, like, it's all in that really – perfectly strategic operation where you know you're ready for a battle. It's kind of like a race. You're preparing your bar like a team prepares a race car for the race. And when the door opens, the race is on. But you have to have a strategy. And that strategy means, you know, you have to have all your, like what we were talking about in the seminar, one-stop shop. When you turn your back to the back bar to grab your ingredients, it's one-stop shop. You turn around, put ice, shake, serve. There is no time lost. If you're losing time, there's something you're doing wrong.
One of the things,
and the thing I want to point out here, because some of our listeners are consumers and some of our listeners are in the business, that's good for everybody. That means you're getting a drink mm-hmm. when you want a drink, and that means the bar serving you a drink when they want to serve you a drink. That's good for everybody.
Yeah, I think, and for those people who are not in the industry too, there's the term mise en place, and basically what that means is that everything has a home. Your setup is the same setup every night, no matter who's working. I think the biggest problem that most bars have is ego. Bartenders are just loaded with ego, and they all want to do things their way. They all want to do things in their style. They want to set up the bar in their way, and they want to have their own regulars even and not share them. And, you know, we've done away with that. We've done away with egos as much as possible. You know, we have to have a little bit of showmanship, of course, but ultimately – We share the identity of the bar. We decide as a group where things go. Everybody is in agreement, and nobody does their own thing. We do it as a team, as a unified group. We share our regulars. That's why if I'm not there on a Saturday, I've introduced them to Dushan. Now they know Dushan. We bring them into our world.
When Francis and I used to bartend in the same bar before we owned our own place, we would purposefully occasionally trade shifts so that his regulars would get to know me and my regulars would get to know him, because it was a one-man bar, so our regulars didn't really get to know the other guy if you were Thursday night regular, so they would be comfortable coming in any night of the week.
Correct. Correct.
One of the things that I think you that was striking about what you said before about this being a profession, and then we talk about setting it up to make money, setting it up to be successful, setting it up to win the race. Yeah. Well, you know, I think that if it is going to be a profession and not a hobby, it's not at odds with it being a profession to think about making it make money, to have the strategy be to make money, because if you don't, then it's not really a profession.
I mean, you're forced to. I mean, just look at the business circumstances in New York City, for example. Look at the rents you have to pay. Look at the terms and leases that the landlords are giving you. Okay, liability insurance. All the other fixed costs that are there every month.
Right.
You know, your utilities, your cost of goods, your payroll. If you have a kitchen, you guys know yourself. You have a restaurant yourself. You know, somewhere that money to pay these people has to come from.
Yep.
And you know, we have this fortune that we learn how to make cocktail menus and put them in place that are actually very profitable by using highest possible ingredients. Fresh squeezed juices, fresh produce every day, and still achieve, you know, a 20% liquor cost.
What?
And, you know, it's like, it's possible. You can do it. And because this is where the highest amount of profit in our restaurants comes from. And that keeps us in business.
Well, and one of the things that people need to realize about cocktails is you have to make money, and you have to do it one $12 transaction at a time. You know, you're not selling $100 bottles of wine here. So, you know, when you're thinking about each cocktail as a transaction, you just cannot spend that much time on the making of the cocktails. And I think that you guys have really struck a great balance. You said before that you kind of considered the bad boys of the industry because, you know, you're speaking a great truth about some of the things that are going on. Some people are out there making great cocktails in a beautiful place, and they're not going to make it.
Sustainability. We talk about it all the time. We talk about it with farmers. Mm-hmm. We talk about it with fishermen. We talk about it with fish stocks and how we produce meat. And we've got to also talk about it when we talk about our bars and our restaurants and what is a sustainable practice.
Right. If you're out of business next week, then you're not sustainable anything.
Exactly.
Great. Thanks for the great cocktail. I'll go someplace for it next week, I guess.
Exactly. I just have one final question for you. It's just I'm curious. Can you give us an idea of, like, what's the volume of lemons and limes that goes through employees only in a day or a week?
Oh, gosh.
How many truckloads?
Well, first of all, I can tell you just the juice alone you're talking about, you know, you have one case is going to start to yield you about a gallon of juice once everything's strained and everything. So, you know, per day you're going through, you know, approximately about at least one case. And, I mean, that's without all the garnished fruit and so forth. So, yeah, we have to we're lucky that we use a produce distributor that will deliver even on Saturdays. So we're able to get the fruit in every day fresh and to just start, you know, basically tearing it apart.
Crazy. Well, if you haven't visited Employees Only or Macau Trading Company, that you should. I'd like to remind everybody that today's show came to you commercial-free because Herradura, the kind people at Herradura Tequila, were kind enough to sponsor this whole show from Tales of the Cocktail. They have a booth down here with some great stuff. We're going to post a Herradura recipe up on the website as well. And Jason Duchon, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for being with us, guys.
Thank you very much. It was truly a pleasure.
Yes, thank you.
Stick with us. The Restaurant Guys will be right back. You're listening to us on WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis, Duchon and Jason were pretty amazing, and it's amazing to see them talk about something that's really relevant, you know? You go to a disco, and all those cheap, crappy cocktails are easy to turn out quickly. Mm-hmm. Many of the really great cocktails are hard to turn out, you know, in a way that will make people happy. If you go to a cocktail bar and you can't get a drink, it doesn't matter how good it would have been if you had gotten one. And these guys are talking about a really important topic in the industry. I think it's funny, they're painfully honest about mm-hmm. how they structure their place. It's a place to be social.
You know, I also want to, and let's talk a little bit about the conference and tie these two things together a little bit. One of the things that's been really great for you and me down here, and hopefully for our listeners at the same time, everybody's just a little bit more relaxed down here.
Yeah.
Everybody's just more, I think we're getting some maybe more honest feedback from everybody. We're getting very good interviews, I think, with people who sitting face to face, sitting at the cocktail conference. We've been sitting with them all day. You know, it's been a lot of fun.
I think for us also, it's interesting to have all these people in one spot, because mm-hmm. these are people that you'd see this person or you'd see that person or two people together, and you know. Audrey and Dale. I used to see Audrey and Dale together all the time back when, you know, before Audrey had the Pegu Club and you know, cocktails didn't matter. We'd go out to lunch, you know, mm-hmm. on a regular basis. And it's hard to get everybody in one room now, you know. It's crazy.
Well, it's easy down here. You know, right, everybody's in one room.
And, you know, the other thing that's going on here, it's amazing how these conferences go. And I think that alcohol has a lubricating effect on a lot of things. Taken in moderation. And I'm surprised the amount of moderation that goes on until, well, after 11:30 or so. But it's great to be able to have these conferences, have these shows where people are showing their own stuff, and then to go out for dinner afterwards and talk to people, run into people in a bar. And it's funny because we are on the other side of our trade and we go out drinking with folks, is you go to other bars and you see how the bars down here are doing. And the bars in New Orleans are mm-hmm. really awesome, really
so,
awesome.
So, again, we have to thank our friends at Herradura and El Jimador for helping us make this show commercial-free. And, of course, helping us get down here to New Orleans to this great conference.
And I hope that you've enjoyed this hour as much as we have broadcast to you from Tales of Cocktails in New Orleans. I am Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.